I'll tell you, there's nothing like a sexy-sounding sax and a Hammond organ to make some really fine jazz music. The boys can't hear that intro, but I'm sure when they listen back to the show, they'll hear it. But I'll tell you, nothing better than a Hammond organ and a saxophone. Love that sound. Welcome to the Mead House. Guys, I think this is, what, episode, like, 46 or something?
Only feels like 27.
Oh yeah, again. Ryan, we know about that, Ryan. So, hey, we're gonna have some fun tonight. We've got a guest who's gonna join us, Tom Riepas. He's a Mazer Cup winner here recently. Actually, he's a cup winner all over the place. We'll get to him here in a little bit. The Mead House, always there on Tuesdays. Of course, you don't know that. You don't know when we record this stuff because we're not live anymore. Replays, always available at the Mead House. You know where that's at, themeadhouse.com. You can pick them up also at iTunes if you want to go mobile. Stitcher Radio has a couple of apps out there. And a little place called Podcastpedia plays our stuff too. So Facebook, real simple. Just go to the Mead House. Type in the Mead House up in that little search deal up there at the top. Ryan Richardson in the house tonight. Aaron is off. He'll be back next week. Mississippi, he's been called to duty tonight. So Chris won't be with us tonight, but Jeff Schaus is in the house. My name is J.D. Webb. So we're going to have some fun tonight. Jeff, were you able to find anything on Facebook this week?
So I got a couple different posts here. And obviously, the big news the last few days has been results for Mead Free or Die. Yours truly took home third in category for my Braggot. And by awesome. The way, let me note, this is the same Braggot recipe that is posted on themeadhouse.com. It was my speculative Saison Braggot from, I believe it was late last summer when we were getting into Braggots initially. And you can find that recipe there along with my suggested tweaks, which I used none of. It came out great right from the start. And couldn't be more pleased that it took home a little medal for me. Our guest tonight also did really well. He had three first in categories and a third place in best in show. A lot of really talented people were involved in that. Congratulations to everybody. And the other thing I noticed on Facebook that I really wanted to point out, on the Mead group, there was a Rushun Harris. He actually shared a project that a gentleman by the name of Pete Halupka is doing. He's doing a bunch of traditionals, but it's experimental in that he's using different natural water sources. So he's got spring water, well water, cave water, and he's making meads with all of those just to kind of investigate.
What did you say? Cave water?
Cave water is what one of his bottles is labeled cave water.
Cave.
I just saw that a little while ago. I think I'm going to reach out to him and see if I can't get him on and talk a little bit more about his experiment, maybe share some results with us when he's got those. But I wanted to give a shout out to that share because that's a really cool, interesting thing. And I would, again, love to see more of that kind of experimentation on Facebook and just in the community.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd be highly interested in knowing what kind of results he gets. Didn't we talk about water? I think maybe
right.
Once here a while back, not too long ago, I think.
If I remember right, Mississippi had proposed an experiment kind of along these lines, using different like adjuncts that beer brewers usually use to get different water quality profiles. I don't know if he followed through and started that or not. This is kind of along the same vein, except instead of adding different chemicals or different additives to increase the quality of the water, he's just using water from different natural sources, apparently. So still an interesting idea, I thought.
Yeah, cool. Very good. Anything else?
That was pretty much what I saw today.
Cool. What are we drinking? I'll start this one off tonight. I'm back Wildflower. I'm going to pull one of these out about every, say 3-4 weeks or so. And I've got a little chart thing that I put together, that I'm going to keep some tasting notes because I want to see if this thing is actually going to change over time. This is one that I have just recently put together, that Polish Wildflower thing. I'm drinking it tonight. It's funny because the last time I had this on the show, I let about half of it sit here and get up to room temperature because I was intrigued the way Ryan talks about his tasting sometimes, where if you let it sit for a little while, it actually changes. And so, as it got up to room temperature, boy, the honey character really started coming out more and more and more. Not so much when it's right out of the refrigerator. So I'll be interested to see as it sits here during the show, if I can still detect that massive amount of Wildflower honey again. But right now, no changes to it. Still tastes good. Nicely hopped. Dig it. It's beer wise, I don't know if beers are dry or not, Ryan, but this is on the dry side as opposed to the sweet side, like my orange stuff that I've done. But I'm digging this. I really love this. Let's move on to Ryan. What are you drinking tonight, bud?
I am drinking a collaborative brew that I was a part of. It's a chestnut brown ale. I'm actually about to drink it. Let me see if I can get you guys a couple of sound effects here.
Oh, I hear that.
Yeah, it's a nice one. It's very, very smooth. It gives a little bit of caramel to it. I wish I could tell you guys it's a Braggot, but it was just a group brew that I was part of, and I'm drinking the last bottle that I have of it. I didn't expect to have one in May, but I had one left, and I said, "Oh, that's what we're drinking tonight."
There you go. Sounds good. Jeff, what'd you pour in your cup tonight? Hello, Jeff.
Sorry, microphone wasn't cooperating with me there. Tonight, I am sampling my new IPA Braggot. This is the one I put together. Geez, it was 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I mainly did it to avoid like spoiling stuff. I had all kinds of hops sitting in my fridge from some that were given to me as part of an awards package from the local homebrew competition last summer, some that I had from other projects just kind of left over, and so I grabbed some malt from my local homebrew store, used a US05 yeast to give it a nice clean character, and some of that basswood honey that I've been playing with for like the Saison Braggot that was at Meat Free or Die this weekend. And man, it has come out nice. It has a really good balance between that kind of residual sweetness from the honey and the hoppiness of I believe I used Apollo hops. They were pretty high alpha acid content for more for this IPA style. The balance is just right there. I think there might be a little too much body from honey. I might scale that back in future batches, but really pleased with how this turned out.
Wow, awesome. Sounds good. And let's go ahead and bring Tom on in. Tom, did you happen to pour anything into a glass tonight?
Well, of course. How could I not be enjoying anything? I didn't want to be left out.
There you go. What are you drinking, bud?
Well, I'm here in Gillette, Wyoming, and I'm drinking one of our local meaderies products. It's called Wild Man, and it's a high alcohol sack mead, 18% ABV. It's really all about the honey forward. It's sweet, but it's not cloyingly sweet. There's nice acid, and they've also put some hops in there. You can't really detect the hops that much, but it gives it a really nice balance. I know session meads are really popular now. This is the opposite of that. I love session meads also. But, yeah, it's a local sack mead, and it's quite delicious.
Sounds good. You know, I think it was Jeff who put this all together. I'm going to turn it over to Jeff and let him make the introductions. And go for it, Jeff.
Well, sure. Tom, who has been gracious enough to join us tonight, really interesting guy. He's a master beekeeper. He's a queen breeder. But really, the topic that we're talking to him about tonight is mead making. He's been a brewer for 25 years, and he's got some really great awards under his belt. The ones that we are kind of most concerned with, of course, are the 2015 and 2017 Best of Show at Maser Cup. I believe, Tom, you're the first and only person to have won that twice. Is that correct?
To my knowledge, that's what they said.
All right.
Wow.
Pretty amazing. And I have to say, it's very humbling also.
Oh, I'm sure. So that was a really brief introduction. I'm sure Tom can fill us in with more details as we go. We had a few questions from some of our listeners. We had some questions from the guys. Where do we want to start with that?
Maybe we could start with Tom just kind of telling us how you got into mead making, or did you start with beer? Did you start with mead? I mean, just walk us through how you got into this hobby and where you've been.
Well, I started about 25 years ago, and I started with beer, malt extract brewing, just like everybody else starts out. My family, my family's European, and my grandfather would make wine, and I remember he would visit us in the summer, and I remember seeing carboys in the basement, and I don't remember what it tasted like, but I do remember seeing cheesecloth in the carboy neck and fruit flies, and at the time I didn't know what that was, but now I'm like, I can't imagine how acidic that wine must have turned out, but I was a beekeeper, and I started with keeping bees at age 13, so I started making beer, and I thought, well, mead doesn't sound that hard. You just mix the honey in some water and throw some yeast, and there was no internet back then, obviously. And of course, I didn't know anything about. No, this was at maybe age 23 or something like that. No, I was not quite that precocious. Yeah, so I didn't know what I was doing, and I can't remember where I found a recipe, but it said, you know, add the acid and add the tannin, and you know, I didn't add nutrients, and it was awful. It was the most disgusting thing that I had made, and I didn't know you hold the acid and tannin until later, and then you use that based on taste to balance the sweetness and, you know, the off flavors from not adding nutrients. And it really was what I saw as a waste of honey. The bees work really hard to make the honey, and as a beekeeper, I'm like, well, I don't want to waste honey like that. So I didn't make mead for a while after that. I made beer and wine and cider, and then I moved on to old grain brewing for beer. But then a number of years later, somebody was doing a fundraiser, and they were like, and the fundraiser was going to be a sort of a medieval Renaissance theme. And they said, well, instead of having champagne, why don't we have mead? And everybody thought, wow, that would be really cool. And then everybody's looking around, and I said, well, where are you going to get the mead? And they said, well, we don't know. And I said, well, let me try my hand and see how it goes. And so I made, I think, 15 gallons for that. Of course, I only had 10 gallons to bring because it was so darn good. We consumed probably 5 gallons ourselves. And that's when I sort of rediscovered mead and really started brewing more and more, to the point that I really don't make a lot of beer anymore. I have a 7-tap system in my home, and you know, it's almost empty except for a sparkling mead that's on there.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And you know, my friends would try what I make, and they'd say, you need to enter competitions. You would win medals. And And I'd say, I don't need no medals. I just like to make it, and you guys like to drink it. It's a perfect relationship, right? And then I can make some more. But I decided to enter some competitions, and I won some medals. And I thought, you know, this is kind of cool. I kind of like this.
You after meddling over the years, do you have any aspirations of or even inspirations of starting a professional meadery, or are you pretty satisfied with just what you're doing?
No, absolutely. Actually, that's where my wife and I are right now. We seriously are looking at places to have a commercial meadery. We live in the Black Hills, which is South Dakota. Mount Rushmore is just down the road, so it's a great tourist location. But the challenge is finding a good location because, you know, in a tourist area, you know, good locations, well, they cost more. So that's kind of where we're at. We're looking at locations. And, you know, every time I make a 5-gallon batch at home, I think in the back of my mind, you know, I could be making a couple of 100 gallons and selling it if only I had a location and I was licensed.
Yeah.
But, yeah, after my first Mazer Cup best of show, that's when I maybe started taking a little bit more seriously and started thinking that maybe I should do this commercially. And that first best of show, I was actually almost not going to enter it because I thought it had some problems. Well, it did actually early in fermentation, but and then after it was done, it was like, I think I'll send it in and see what the judges think and see if they can give me any tips to make it better. And I couldn't believe it when I got the best of show.
Yeah. Wow.
So
Yeah.
It was a sparkling strawberry melomel, and it was I can't remember if it was sweet or semi-sweet, but I was basically trying to make something like a Moscato, but with strawberries and honey. And that's kind of what I had wanted. I wanted it to be balanced, the sweet, balanced with the acid, and I wanted it to be highly carbonated, something that you would drink a glass and you would enjoy. And that was the first time that I'd ever worked with strawberries, and I didn't know it then, but they can be kind of challenging to work with. You can get some off flavors early in fermentation. And at one point it was like nail polish remover. I mean, literally. And it was from the ethyl acetate, which is like a volatile acidity. And at one point my wife and I were trying this and we looked at each other and we're like, is this even safe to drink? And, you know, we thought, did somebody accidentally pour some nail polish remover into this? And I thought it was ruined. And the one thing about making any alcoholic beverage, mead or wine, is people who are experienced, they still make mistakes or things still turn out maybe not how we'd want it to. But someone who is experienced, we know how to fix it or how to change it before it gets to be a problem. And so as we were pouring it back and forth in the glass, it kind of dissipated. And we left a glass out overnight because we didn't feel like drinking it because it wasn't very good. And the next morning, actually, all of that acetone, it kind of dissipated. And I thought, you know, it's kind of volatile. Why isn't there, maybe there's a way for me to get rid of it. And so I decided, what if I rack it into a carboy, but instead of putting it down into the bottom, as we all do, and letting it fill up to avoid oxygen, you put it on the side so it goes right down the sides. Mm-hmm. But of course, I didn't want it to be ruined. I didn't want it to be oxidized. So I thought, well, if I fill it up with an inert gas, which is carbon dioxide, I bled off into my, or from my CO2 system, from my kegging system, I just fill that carboy up with carbon dioxide, and I bled that melomel down the sides. And of course, I had sulfited it beforehand because I didn't want to ruin it. And I did that about 4 or 5 times, and it went away. But, you know, when you have a memory of something, you think it's kind of like a child. You know, maybe she was a spoiled brat. But then she grows up and the world thinks of her as something beautiful. But you just think, boy, she was a spoiled brat, you know, and you can't see what she became. And so I sent it into I just wanted to get tips. I wanted the judges to, you know, say, well, you might try this next time. And so I remember I was waiting. I had not gone to the Mazer Cup, or I couldn't stay. Actually, I was there, but I had to leave early. And I was looking at the posting of the awards and or the medals, and they hadn't announced the best of show right away, but I saw that I got first place in the category, and I couldn't believe it. I'm like, what? And so I had to go to bed. I had to go to work the next morning. So the next morning, I opened my eyes. I turned on my smartphone. I didn't have my glasses on, and I'm reading best of show, and I see my name. And, of course, I said a couple of words I won't share on air, but my wife's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, I can't believe this. Look, I thought it was a joke or something.
Wow.
And I guess it goes to show you that as meat is developing, you know, it's like it's a living organism. The yeast is fermenting, and then it's changing, and then chemically it's changing. You know, even if it gets some really funky off odors or flavors, if you can catch them and you can address them, maybe all is not lost.
Yeah.
But yeah, I still couldn't believe it.
How old was that mead, that first one, that strawberry?
That one probably was maybe, let's see, Mazer is in March, right? So
yep.
I probably made that in the end of the summer. So that probably would I made. I probably pitched that sometime in August. So it was less than a year old.
Wow. Now, do you, you said you were a beekeeper. Do you mm-hmm. use the honey that your bees produce in your meads, or do you also use other honey sources?
I do both. I love to use my own honey. You have kind of a connection to it. You have a connection to the bees, of course. But I also like to use other kinds of honey, too. We don't have orange trees in South Dakota, so obviously I can't, you know, I have to bring that in. One of my meads that got a first place at Mead for Your Diet was a coffee blossom honey, and I made that into a sparkling mead also. So, yeah, I do purchase some. The honey that was in the strawberry, and then also in the other Best of Show that I got, that was a sweet clover from 2014. And that year was a very unique year because we had 2 years of rain, and the sweet clover, they call them a clover flow or a clover year. This doesn't happen all the time, but maybe once every 10 years, the prairie is covered with sweet clover. I mean, it's literally yellow from horizon to horizon. And you can't put enough boxes on your beehives to collect all this clover. But because there's so much, you really get the pure sweet clover. Because, you know, whenever you buy honey and they say it's orange blossom, well, it's not 100% orange blossom, unless they put it right in the middle of an orchard, you know, with nothing around for miles. And so that sweet clover honey had really strong, almost cinnamon-like, spice-like notes. And it you didn't really detect it as much in that strawberry, but some of the other meads that I had made with that sweet clover, it really came through, which was pretty neat. But other years, it's more subdued, so you don't really see that, you don't smell that or taste that as much.
So is that the kind of honey that you're collecting? Is it primarily clover, or is it a wildflower?
Primarily sweet clover. Last year we had a drought, and the sweet clover didn't bloom very much, so then it was more alfalfa, so you didn't get as much. And sometimes in a wet year, we'll get a wildflower flow in the fall, but I usually leave that for the bees. You know, they need to have enough honey to basically survive the winter. And, you know, it's one of the worst things a beekeeper can do is get a little greedy and take too much honey, and then, oh, no, they're going to starve, and then you have to feed them back a whole bunch of sugar. That doesn't really make any sense. I mean, not that I've been there, of course, unintentionally, but, you know, I like to leave enough honey for the bees.
You, in 2016, your second runner-up to Best of Show, pineapple, mango, habanero, and ghost peppers. That actually sounds like a pretty nice glaze for a pork roast or grilled chicken.
Well, that's kind of the idea. I was thinking like Caribbean, you know, and
yeah.
I wanted to do something with hot peppers, and I had tried at the previous Mazer Cup. They have a mead mixer, and I don't know if any of you have gone to a Mazer Cup, but I really strongly encourage it. There's a mead mixer where you can try all these commercial meads, and then there's all these informal after parties around the hotel. So you pretty much can just walk around and you hear a party on the other side of the door, and you just knock, and you know, if you brought mead, you're pretty much welcome to come in there. But then the volunteering they're always looking for volunteers. Even if you're not a judge, you can steward. They're always looking for help, and you get to try a lot of different meads even as part of the judging process. So when the judges are done, I mean, you'll ask if you have some extra, you know, don't pour it out. They'll let you have a taste of something that's really good or not good if you want to learn that too. But I was at that meat mixer, and I tried, Mike Fairbrother had a capsomel, and I was kind of, I love hot food. I love spicy food, but I never really had a hot pepper alcoholic beverage. I had tried a hot pepper beer, and it didn't work. It was too hot and too vegetal. And, you know, and something about carbonation and heat, it makes it burn more. I mean, if I'm eating hot food, I might want a cold beer to cool it down. I don't want to have a drink to heat myself up.
Right. Yeah.
But I had tried, I tried Mike's, I think it was Fury, and it was so, it was delicious, and it was so well balanced, and it was hot, but then it was exactly like you described it. It just, it came down with the sugar balanced it perfectly. And by the end of your glass, you know, you've had a nice warmth in your mouth, but it wasn't like you were burning. It's not like you needed to have a chaser of cold water. And I thought, I want to do that. And so that's what I was trying to aspire to, is to make something with hot peppers that it would warm up, it would take off, and then at, right as the it would finish, the sugar would come and balance it out, and you just have a little bit of warmth left, and then you'd be wanting to take another sip.
This is
and
one
I thought,
of
well,
those,
what goes well with?
I was going to say this is one of those things that's on my to-do list only because my wife loves, like you, she loves hot spicy food. I mean, she's the hot sauce queen of the house here. There's a little place in a farmer's market close to where we live in LA that has hundreds, if not thousands, of bottles of different kinds of Tabasco sauces and whatnot.
Yeah, and exactly. But you have to be careful because if the hot peppers are overdone, I mean, you shouldn't be needing it like, oh my gosh, I need a glass of water to, you know, to cool myself down.
Well,
because that's overpowered.
Yeah, my question would be, you know, you used habanero and ghost peppers. Why the two? Mm-hmm. Because as far as for me, they're both hot. I mean, that's just, you know, they're both like way over the top for me. But why the habanero and ghost? Was there something about the individual peppers that flavor wise or
yeah? So if you can get past the heat of a habanero, you know, they're one of the hottest peppers there are. But if you can get past that heat, it almost has like fruity or tropical fruit notes. And a ghost chili is almost like a smokiness. It's not really a true smoky. I mean, not like a chipotle or something like that. And so, like, when you're having a wine, often a blended wine is better than, you know, a one that's made from a single grape. And so that's what I was kind of aspiring to. I tried other hot peppers that were mixed with different ones, and so sometimes it's good to use more than one variety. Now, you don't want to overdo it. If you had like eight kinds, you know, it would all be muddled together.
Yeah.
But the other thing I did is I made sure I used dried peppers, because one of the things I didn't like about some of the other capsules that I had was they had too much vegetal, like green pepper, you know, and they'd use green jalapenos, which is fine. It's just not my personal preference. I like the richness of a dried pepper rather than the greenness of a green pepper. And so what I had done is I used dried habaneros and dried ghost chilies. And green pepper flavor is perfectly fine if that's what you like, but that's just not my personal preference.
Go ahead.
I was very worried I was going to overheat it. So what I did is I put it in after the primary fermentation was done and after I'd had the pineapple and mango and I was ready to add the peppers, I put in about a cup of each, and this is about 5-gallon batch. Well, by then it was probably maybe less than that, maybe 4 gallons. And then I tasted it every single day. And when it got to where it was a tiny bit more hot than I wanted it to, I took it off. Because I was really worried that, because you can always add more, but you cannot take it out.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, is, you know, how did you get to the point where you knew enough was enough? So it's just like
that's
everything else, a lot of things that we add in secondary. I mean, you get to a point, taste it, when it's enough, pull it out and call it good. So interesting.
And so the pineapple and mango, you know, I basically thought what goes well with habaneros, and you think Caribbean, you think jerk sauce, and you know, I thought, would it be good with pineapple? Would it be good with only mango? Would it be good with both? And you know, then I just decided, you know, I think those are going to be a really, really great combination. One of the things, like, so when you're making a mead that has multiple ingredients in it, and you know, on the judging side, I didn't even realize this as much until after I became a judge, and then I realized how important it is. If you know, let's say you pick 4 ingredients, if you put those 4 ingredients in there, it doesn't matter what combination you're doing. If you put those, you know, you list all of them. Let's say it's a berry mellow melon. You have black cherry and blackberry and I don't know, black currant and whatever other fruit you put in there, raspberry. The hardest part about that is the flavors can be all muddled together, and then you really can't tell. You know, well, it's a fruit something, but I really can't distinguish any of those flavors. And so that's how points can get taken off from an entry like that, because it's just the flavors, you just can't really tell. It's just this purple melomel thing. And so that's what when I made that that pineapple mango habanero ghost chilies, I really wanted the pineapple and the mango to be both, to be forward, and also to that you can tell that they were there, because you could have a meat and yeah, there's some tropical fruit there, but I really can't tell. Is that pineapple? Well, they say so. I think maybe I can tell. And is there mango? Yeah, it's kind of light, a little orange. Maybe it's there. You're almost, if you list something on the entry form that they can't taste, you'll actually be at a disadvantage. You're almost better not saying that it was there.
Yeah. Interesting. Jeff, I know Aaron had some questions that he sent in. Aaron wasn't able to be with us tonight, but did you get anything from him? I think Jeff.
Yeah, I did.
There's a few questions.
I'm sorry. It took me a second. I'm pulling that up right now. So let's see here. The first question that Aaron had was if you had any kind of a secret to success or a key process that was you think is really a key or a secret to what you're doing.
Well, I think it's a lot of, you know, if you're on the mead making group, you know, the one that I'm one of the moderators with, and with John Talkington, one of the things that we stress is, you know, good mead making process. And that starts with several things. I mean, number one, just high quality ingredients. So you want really high quality honey. I mean, sometimes people say, oh yeah, I went to my local big box store and I got this honey. It was really cheap and it was great. It might not even be honey. It might be, you know, contaminated with high fructose corn syrup. And, you know, sure, you'll make something that'll give you a buzz, but it might not taste as good as it could. Although sometimes you can get decent honey at those stores. With the fruit or the spice, you want to really get something that's going to give you the flavor. So that's going to be either fresh or frozen fruit, you know, versus a juice versus a puree. And then maybe, you know, an extract would be the you know, you'd never want to use that. And same thing with spices, you know, like, for example, I've made a mead hito, so it's honey and mint and lime juice, and it's sparkling. It's not very complex, but it's like a mead hito, you know, it's delicious. In fact, one of the competitions I entered that in, the judges made a comment. They said, wow, this doesn't seem like a standard mead. This is more like a hydromel. And I laughed because I know it was definitely a standard. It was around 11%, but I made it more carbonated on purpose. And by doing that, you make the alcohol seem less. It doesn't seem as warm on your tongue. So I had a good chuckle at that. I was not offended at all. I thought, well, that was, you know, that was my mead making secret. And if you wanted to come to my house and have a bottle of that and see how well you can walk after that, that would be a lot of fun. But so, a lot of this is the art of mead making. But so then you pick the right ingredients. So the next thing you need to think about is your yeast. I guess water would be the next thing. But myself, I don't really worry about water because we have really great well water. It's high in carbonates, and so that means that in a traditional mead, I don't really have to worry about the pH dropping too low, as I might if I was making a, you know, like some melomel with high acid fruit or something like that. I know some folks, they use tap water or distilled water. I know tap water, if there's chlorine in it, that might be a problem, but if they have to, then they can buy some. You can buy like a spring water or something at the store if you need to. But I'm very lucky. We just use water right out of the tap because it comes out of a well. But then the next decision you have is what type of yeast. And I think everybody has their favorites. I've used a lot of different yeast over the years, but I kind of pick them, you know, based on what I'm trying to do or what I'm trying to ferment. For example, if I'm making a melomel or a piment, I really like 7-1-B 11-22. And part of the reason is it can metabolize malic acid and make it seem a little bit softer. Mm-hmm. One of the things about 7-1-B is it's not it doesn't have the killer factor in it. So not a problem with mead, but if you were making a wine out of pressed grapes and it was like a lot of wild yeast in there, it might not compete as well. So you might have to make sure you pitch a really, you know, a starter that was, you know, a high number of yeast cells and it was pitched and it just took off. For my traditionals, like a traditional standard, I like QA23. It gives a lot of aromatics and it has has low nutrient requirements. So I like, and I think it's one of the fructophilic yeasts. So fructophilic yeast. So honey is mostly fructose and some wine yeast doesn't like to ferment that as well. So especially if there's not any other sugars from the fruit or anything like that. So sometimes we'll prefer to use a fructophilic yeast. So the wine yeast that prefers or will ferment fructose. So most wine yeasts prefer to ferment glucose first and then fructose. So I use QA23 for traditional meads. I've used D47 also. I know some mead makers don't like that because it's a little bit picky about temperature. But if you treat it properly, it works well. And then for my sack meads, I like K1V1116. I know some folks like EC1118. EC1118 is really aggressive, but it doesn't really leave a lot of esters or any of the aromatics. So, if I have a stuck fermentation, I have not had a stuck fermentation for years, but I would probably use K1V also because it has just as high an alcohol tolerance as does EC1118, but you get some more floral esters from that, especially if you ferment it at a lower temperature.
What kind of setup do you have at home for doing for making your mead, temperature controls, that kind of thing? How do you handle all that?
So I do more fermenting in the fall and winter. We live up in the mountains, so we don't even have air conditioning. But in the summer, it can get pretty hot, and we don't have a basement. So typically, my fermentation I'm doing in the fall and winter, and it kind of works out very conveniently because there's not much beekeeping to do in the fall and winter. In the summer, I'm too busy out with the bees anyway to be spending time making mead. So I tend to do it, and we just put in a cool part of our house. We heat our house mostly with a wood stove, so the house isn't like central heated, so there's a lot of cooler spots that we can put in a corner or something like that. My wife, she teases me. The real reason why we need to go commercial is so that I can get all the carboys out of the house. I mean, you go to the guest bathroom, it's like there's a mad scientist lab set up, and you know, there are these carboys in there, and then like the dining room has carboys, and then there's a closet. So that's the real reason is to go commercial, is get all that stuff out of it, and we can have the house back.
I hear you.
My wife has the same complaint.
Don't they all?
Yeah.
Except for Ryan. I think Ryan, don't you have your own little corner down in the basement, Ryan?
Yeah, so I live in Minneapolis, and we have a basement, you know, a true basement. And I ferment in the, I have a, technically it's a bedroom. I mean, it's got an egress window. It's a legal bedroom that I've commandeered as the fermenting room, as I like to call it. And, you know, it stays in the low to mid 60s year round. You know, right now it's about 62 degrees in there, and in the summer, it might go to 65, 66, but it stays pretty consistent. So I that's where I do most of my work. I don't have a heater or a chiller or jackets or anything on it. I just use it right there. And so, yeah, I typically pick yeasts that can operate in that temperature zone. Or I find yeast that I can push to that temperature zone, you know, if that might just be a little bit lower than what they like, or a little higher than what they like, depending on what yeast I'm using. I don't know. I had something else, but it works. It works. So I was going to say it's too cold. It's too cold for Ricky Grunfeld meadery. Work, and I don't have an extra aquarium set up that I can, you know, put a saltwater heater on up to 600 degrees.
I have to interject here, by the way. I had a after my moderate success from last week, I set up four more in that aquarium this week, and he is not kidding with the hydrogen sulfide. Once I had all four going, oh my God, the stench of eggs. I had to like clean out the water and replace everything today. It was just getting too bad to bear.
Did you put any fish in it yet?
There is no way fish are going to live with all that hydrogen sulfide. About all of those things.
Yeah, and Jeff is in Kansas City, and Tom, I'm in Southern California, just 12 miles north of L.A. So my cooling setup is pretty elaborate, involving a $300 cooler, some pumps, and some immersion chillers. So we run the gamut here on the show between the five of us. And if Aaron was here, he'd tell you something different. And then Chris, he's also in Mississippi, where it gets quite humid and hot during the summertime, and he's even got a different setup. So, the show, Tom, we're all about home mead making, and our focus is on just that. I'm interested. You kind of talked a little bit about some of the things that you have done that has led to your success. I'm all about best practices. And if you can go into a little more detail on maybe one or two things that you found that really worked for you, that helped you produce good mead at home when you first started out. Were there a couple of things that you discovered early on that really led to the success that you're having now?
Well, one, and I don't do anything that anybody else can't do. I mean, this is all out there. And so one of the other ones we kind of alluded to, but staggered nutrient additions are really important. I've tried all of them. I've tried I use mainly DAP and Firm K now, but I've done Firmo only, did the Taylor Organic SNA. I've used Firm K only. And there are some differences. You can sometimes, if you use too much Firmo, you can taste that. But they all work, and it's really about the yeast getting fed at the proper time. Giving all of the nutrient addition at once, that's not really what you want to do, but you're kind of feeding it. It's like kind of going, some people use the analogy of a marathon, but I would say it's like a 10-day backpack trip. I mean, you need to rehydrate it well in GoFirm so that it's ready to go. It has all of the nutrients and the sterols and the vitamins and the fatty acids it needs to get started, and then you put that in, and then as it starts fermenting at 24 hours, you put your first nutrient addition, and then 24 hours later, you do that, and then at 30% sugar depletion or 7 days, you put in the last one. I actually never have to go to 7 days because mine is already so rapid that it's at 30%. And at the same time that I do the nutrient additions, I'm also oxygenating. That's another thing. A lot of us, we would stir it or shake it, and you're degassing it. You're removing some of the carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is toxic to yeast. But the yeast also needs some oxygen, particularly early on in fermentation, during the exponential growth phase. That's basically when the fermentation lock is actively bubbling and the yeast is replicating. And so I actually will use an O2, like an oxygenator with like a little stainless steel stone. You can buy them at any of the winemaking shops online. And that both degasses, it removes the carbon dioxide while it stirs up the lees a little bit, which you kind of want that to happen also. And then it adds oxygen. And I think, I can't remember, I think it was White, White Labs? I think that they, or wasn't, there was one book, and it was called Yeast. And I think they compared the amount of oxygen you add by shaking vigorously for 5 minutes versus using a stainless steel stone with oxygen for like, I think it was 2 minutes. And you can't even come close to the amount of oxygen by shaking it or stirring it. So that's, I will do that also. I'll use the oxygen maybe with the first two nutrient additions. You don't want to do it too late, obviously, because then you'll leave oxygen in there and you'll oxidize your mead, and then that's a problem. But that's one of my other practices that I do in addition to the staggered nutrient additions that we all do. And then I've gotten really diligent about monitoring pH, especially for, you know, something that has acid in it, like a melomel is a perfect example, you know, with either juice or with fruit. If you don't want those pHs to get too low, because that can be a problem. I never had a problem with a traditional meat because our water is hard water and it's alkaline. But if it drops too low when you're making, I don't know, black currant or any citrus fruit, that can really stress the yeast out and you can get some off flavors from that.
Interesting.
And the other thing too is, and it's meat is so interesting in that it's really, it's science and it's art, and it's both. And you can know the process really well and you can do it the same and it'll be really good, but it won't be like, it just needs an extra, and that's the art. It's because I get asked, oh, what's your recipe? And it's, you could have five people do the same recipe and it would turn out differently because of the temperature or the yeast they used or how they handled it. But part of it is that the yeast is actually growing. It's a living organism. You're like a farmer, you know, and one year it might be rainy and then you can't get out in the fields and plant your grain, but the next year it might be a drought. Maybe you might not even plant the grain. And so with the yeast, it's like that too. It's a living organism and you have to be monitoring it along the way, you know, maybe taking you know, measuring the bricks or, you know, definitely tasting it. That's a fun part, actually, it's tasting it. But, you know, smelling it, if it's got like hydrogen sulfide, you know, I had a pine mint that was sitting on the leaves for a little bit too long and I smelled it and it was stinky. It was like, oh no, it was like, it wasn't hydrogen sulfide. It wasn't eggs. It was more of a, and it wasn't mercaptan. So it wasn't like the asphalt. It was kind of like like stinky gym socks. And I knew that was from some of the sulfides, not sulfite, but sulfides. And one of the first things you can do is you can just rack it off of that. And a lot of that's very volatile. But if you let it go, then you would really get that rotten egg and worse yet, the mercaptans in there, and you could never get it out of there. So some of it's just paying attention to things as they're happening. The next batch you make, the same recipe, same honey, same fruit, it might not even do that.
Guys, any other questions for Tom?
When do you prefer to add your, whether it's fruit or spices, are you doing that in primary or secondary, or is it a combination?
That's a good question. I've done it all different ways. I've added the fruit up front. I've added part of the fruit up front and then some later on. There's times when I added it all right out at the end of primary. So there was still some yeast activity, and by adding the fruit, it did start becoming more active again. One of the things I found, though, you know, so if you have a high sugar fruit and you want the yeast to ferment that, like any other sugar, whether it's the honey or whatever else you're adding, if you add it earlier or in the primary, they'll kind of work at that. I mean, now big chunks of fruit they can't really get into, but so, like, you know, that could be anything. It could be berries or something like that. But if you want to sort of preserve some of those fresh fruity aromas, I find that adding it later, there's a little alcohol present. It can help sort of dissolve some of those aromatics. What's really one of the important ways of preserving those fruity aromas is you don't want it to be oxidized. So, you know, it's right about the point when fermentation is finished, and then I'll sulfite it to protect it. And in winemaking, you know, in winemaking, they call this reductive style of winemaking. And so with that would be like a Sauvignon Blanc or something like that. You're trying to keep it fresh. You're trying to keep it fruity. It's totally a different style than if you were going to make, oh, I don't know, one of those wonderful Polish meads, you know, that are, you know, aged for a long time and they're oxidized, or maybe like a pie mint or something where you do want a little oxidation with age will give it, you know, some character. So that's one of the things I'll often do. And I did that with the pineapple mango. The fruit went in kind of late. And then same thing with the strawberry. And that way you get more. When you get a glass of something like this, you want it to be like the fruit is right there in the glass. I mean, if you close your eyes, it's like I can smell the fruit. You want it to be right there in front of you. And you don't want it to be so subdued that you have to really imagine, well, was there fruit in this?
Yeah. That's the difficult thing with doing I've done a couple of Mellow Mellows here that I just haven't been satisfied with, and I think the reason being because when they turn out, it as much as they taste like the fruit that went in it, it tastes like unripened fruit, and I think that's indicative of the fruit that I get here in Southern California is picked way before it's ripe. So consequently, you know, you're stuck with using stuff that really you really shouldn't be using. That includes the berries, even the blackberries that we get. You know, I mean, it's just everything from oranges to apples to you name it. And you can't just leave it out on a table and think it's going to ripen that way, because that's not ripe. Ripe occurs on the tree, on the bush. You know, and at that point is when you want to pick it and use it and whatever you're going to, you know, bake or make a mead with. So that's the difficult part that I have in using fresh fruit.
Absolutely. If you pick it at green, like a lot of the fruit we buy in the store, and then you just let it sit there, it's not going to be the same as if you went off and you picked it right off the tree or right off the bush the day that it was perfectly ripe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so true. But it's hard because, you know, there's fruits that I don't grow. So, you know, that's fruits that you just can't get, but other, you know, then you buy it. Sometimes getting it frozen, if it was picked and then they flash froze it, that can be really actually pretty good. And the softening from the freezing action sometimes lets the you get more of the flavor and juice that way. So a good quality frozen fruit can be really, really good.
Now, is most of the stuff that you make semi-sweet or sweet? You kind of mentioned both of those lately, or both of those in this conversation.
So my own personal preference, I tend to like dry meads. I actually prefer if it's a dry traditional or even a dry pie mint. That's my preference. You know, I like my wine dry, but I also know that a lot of people, you know, they like sweet and they hear honey and they want it to be sweet. And so one of the problems that I've had with sweet wines or sweet meads or whatnot that I've had is they're out of balance. So they're almost like sugar syrup. And, you know, you'll try a glass of that and you're like, well, that's nice. But you're not going to want to have another glass because you just still have that sugar kind of on your, you know, all over your mouth and in your tongue. And so one of the things that is really important is to find balance in your mead. And so just because a mead is sweet, it doesn't mean it has to be out of balance. And so there's different ways to achieve that balance. A simple way is just to add acid. So, you know, if you add acid, then it'll seem less sweet. And then it also will sort of cut the sugar off of your palate so that, you know, you're ready to have another sip. You know, you think of a lemonade, you know, that's thirst quenching. It's sweet and it's sour. If you took away just the lemon juice and it was just sugar water, that wouldn't be very good. On the other hand, if it was just the lemon juice in the water without the sugar, that wouldn't be very good either. And then the tannins can also balance sweetness. So like some of the dessert wines that maybe like a port, you know, it's sweet and there's alcohol, it's high alcohol, but it also has a fair amount of tannin in there. So that gives it that complexity and that flavor. And then the third way you can balance the sweet, which is one of my favorite ways, is carbonation. So, think about having a soda pop that went flat. It's just kind of not very good. But if you had it carbonated, you know, it's delicious. It's thirst quenching. You finish it, you're ready to have some more. And it's not like I'm trying to get everybody intoxicated, but that's kind of what you want. I mean, you want somebody to finish that glass and say, wow, this is really good. Let me have another one. That's what I try to achieve, whether I'm making a sweet or a dry or whatnot, is I try to find that balance with all of those characteristics. So that's why that's as important is the balancing it in those flavors is just as important as doing a really good, you know, having good processes in your early fermentation. It's just as important as trying to do those additions later on, whether it's the acid or tannin or carbonation.
What are your thoughts on stabilizing a mead that's completely dry?
So, stabilizing it for future, are you going to back sweeten it or just, you know, stabilize it?
you're going to leave it completely dry. Now we've, and the reason I bring up this question is we've had professional guests on before that have sulfited meads that are, you know, below one in gravity. They've completely fermented out. There's no risk of any additional fermentation, but they do it anyway. And the reason I ask is that it's something that I personally don't do very much of, but I know that other folks say that that helps protect the flavor. So what?
I'm just curious
as to your thoughts on stabilizing a completely dry mead that you do not intend to back sweeten.
So I have to admit, years ago, I was like, I don't want no sulfites. I was anti-sulfite. And then I had a few bottle bombs, but even I didn't have those. I had a delicious mead. It was so wonderful. We opened a bottle 6 months later, and it went bad. And it just breaks your heart. You know, it's a waste of honey, and it was so good, and it went bad, whether it turned acetic or whatever happened. So sulfite is, an antimicrobial. So, you know, if you're having a sweet or semi-sweet mead and you've stabilized it with sulfite and sorbite so it doesn't start fermenting again. But even in a dry mead, other things can happen too. And sulfite is a good antioxidant. And so it helps preserve those fresh flavors. That's probably one of the things that the strawberry had a fair amount of sulfite to start with. And then also the pineapple mango. You have to be careful though. You don't want to overdo it. So I'm very, careful to base my sulfite additions on my pH, because the lower the pH, the less sulfite you need. And I know pH might, you know, a lot of homebrewers are like, well, I don't really, you can get a decent pH tester for not too much. I mean, we've invested a lot of money in our kegging systems and our carboys and everything. So even if all you do is test the pH and then base your sulfite additions off of that, you're going to be really far ahead rather than just basing it off of, you know, however many Camden tablets you want to add to the carboy. But yeah, and you know, the amount of sulfites I'm adding, I mean, it might be only 25, you know, maybe 30 parts per million, depending on, you know, what the pH is. But I think I read somewhere commercial wine, like a red wine, it's like 76 parts per million on average, and a white wine is like 100 and something. So commercial wine is much higher than even what a lot of us are doing who are sulfiting it. I know sulfiting is a kind of some people have strong opinions about that, but I don't like to have a really good mead go bad on me. It's really disheartening to have that happen.
I think the biggest concern, this is where I wish Chris was here. I think the biggest concern out there about stabilizing and sulfiting everything are allergies and that kind of thing. And
there are a few people who have it, but it's really, really rare. I mean, those people can't eat lunch meat, or they can't eat like dried apricots or anything.
Right, right.
And the headache part, that's kind of been disproven. The headache from a sulfite, you know, a lot of people say, I'm not going to drink red wine because of the sulfites, so they drink white wine. But what I just told you is actually white wine has more sulfites on average than red wine does. There's other compounds in red wine that give people headaches. But usually it's just from drinking too much. I mean, really, let's be honest.
Yeah,
you know,
bottom line.
I
don't
drink too much, and, you know, that's probably why you get a headache. Alcohol does that.
I think we've all been there. I think we're all probably experts on that. Yeah, the especially the sweet stuff, right? That's why I'm just a beer drinker. gosh, Tom, some good stuff here. If you want to stick around a bit longer, I don't know what your time's like. We've got one more segment that we got to get to before the show's over. We do have plenty of time. Jeff, do you have any other questions?
I can hang on a little longer. Yeah.
Jeff, anything else from Aaron at all?
Let me hop back over there real quick.
You mentioned, you know, one of the after dinner drinks that my wife and I enjoy, Tom, is a nice port wine. And it's kind of been in the back of my mind about creating some kind of a port out of a mead. Have you ever crossed that path at all or considered something like that?
That is on my bucket list, actually. I would like to make a either a fortified mead, you could ferment high enough to be equivalent to a port or a sherry for that matter. And, to get those rich oxidized flavor notes, the closest thing to that would be some of those Polish oxidized meads, which are amazing. Have you ever had any of those Polish meads?
My wife has, come on guys, what's that stuff called? I talked about it here a couple of, come on, Ryan, what is that stuff my wife likes, that stuff I talked about?
Danish Viking blood?
Yeah, Viking blood. You're talking about something like that?
No, that's I've had that too. That's pretty strong, but it's I cannot speak Polish, so I'm not going to say the names of some of the ones that I've had, because I'll mispronounce them embarrassingly. But they're so smooth, and the oxidation, if you had an oxidation in this like light fruit mead, that would be like a fault, and the judges would score, it takes points off. But in a well-aged mead like that, it gives this nuttiness. Like in a sherry, you can get acetaldehyde, so you get this creaminess or this softness that you wouldn't get if it was much younger. You know, the Viking's blood I've had that was a little bit, it was a little bit more hot and maybe a little bit more. I mean, it was good in its own way, but it was different than the Polish meads I'm talking about. You know, a really good mead maker is Marek from he's from Poland. He was the guy who got a second runner up at Mead for Your Die this year, and I think that was probably the same entry that he got Best of Show at Domras. I don't know. I didn't actually ask him, but I know I did try his Best of Show that at Domras Cup this spring. I was a judge there. I didn't get to judge it, but when they were done, I was fortunate enough to be standing there, and they gave me a little taste of it, and it was really wonderful. And that's, I don't make mead like that. I'm really, my skill set is in making really fresh fruity meads. I make a lot of sparkling meads. That's not all that I make, but I've not really delved into making more of these aged meads or some of the higher alcohol sack meads that you can have too. And so that's an area that I have not done. That's a challenge for me, actually. I mean, you need to start making some of those and see if I could even win some medals making those.
Yeah. Jeff, did you find anything from Aaron?
No, I think pretty much if we didn't ask directly, Tom has covered it on his own. So I think we've got everything on the list here.
What if you were to advise a home brewer just starting out making mead, Tom, is there a particular recipe out there that you would advise that they start out with, or how would you go about telling somebody how to start if they wanted to learn how to make mead?
You know, that's a really good question. I've been doing it for so long. I have a lot of folks ask me, "Oh, what was your recipe?" And they hadn't made it before. And it's almost like learn the process first, and then you don't need it. You'll never need a recipe. You'll be able to make whatever you want. But I understand when you're first starting out, you kind of need to, you need to follow the basics. I know that there's some mead recipes on our Mead Makers Forum that John Talkington has put up that a lot of the folks on that forum really like. But it's really important temperature control, stagger nutrient additions, using a good quality wine yeast. They all work. There are, some people have their favorites. And then after the fermentation is done, protecting it with sulfite and, if necessary, sorbate if you're going to sweeten it. But I tend to ferment dry and then back sweeten. Just I have more control. That's just what I do. But so then those additions are all later, and base that on taste. And don't just add it until your main batch and then see how it turns out. Do little tasting trials and then decide what you want. And that's really fun. I enjoy doing that. And my wife and I will do, we try this and do you like that? No, let's make it a little bit different. And that's one of the fun parts of mead making is after it's been fermented and now you're deciding what additions you want to add. I'm talking about, back sweetening with honey or acid additions or something like that. But yeah, I know. I think we have some recipes on our Mead Makers Forum, and there's some great books out there too. I mean, Ken Tram's book is great, and then Steve Piazza's book. I don't know if I just said his name wrong, but they've got some great introductory recipes, and of course, Rob Ratliff came out with his new book, and that he's got some great recipes in that book. So there's some great recipe books out there for someone starting out, I would recommend just don't start with anything too complicated. Some folks are, I want to do a wild fermented, hopped braggot, and all this. It's like, just start with a basic, either a traditional mead or maybe like a mellow mel. They're very forgiving. You know, anything with a little bit of fruit in there, they're very forgiving. So that's what I would recommend starting out with.
Speaking of braggots, you just touched on my, that's my category. I finally found something that after trying, many different other kinds of meads and also drinking some commercially made meads, I have found my category, and that's in braggots. I really dig this. Have you done anything with braggots at all?
I have. I have not won a medal with the braggot yet, so I it's kind of funny. I'm trying to look at, okay, I've won medals in all the categories. Which one have I not won a medal in? And so I haven't in the braggot or the sizer. Well, I haven't actually made a lot of sizers.
Let me stop there, because let me just stop you there, Tom, because now we can say between you and I, we've won medals in all the categories.
Yeah. Well, cool. I don't know. It's just funny. It's like,
go ahead.
It's funny how it's like, you do something. It's like, well, that's not good enough. I need to challenge myself. I'm like, okay, look, how can I outdo myself next time? Some people would just rest on their laurels and say, "Oh yeah, it's good enough." So that's not how I work.
You find, at these competitions that you go to, are there a lot of braggots being judged, or do you find that that's a category that is seldom done?
It's not as popular as the traditionals or the melomels. The sizers are a popular category also. I have not judged a braggot as a meat judge. I have not judged in the braggot category yet, but just looking, you can look at the number of entries. Most of the competitions many of them will say, out of so many entries, and if somebody got first, second, and third, but there were only four entries, that's nice, but it's not as much. It doesn't mean as much as if there was a whole bunch of entries. But it's not as popular as some of the other categories, but
what do you think that is?
I don't know. I think a lot of people, they think of mead as, well, and it, you could make it with a malt extract, but a lot of us, you'd want to make it with an all grain. So I think a lot of folks maybe gravitate to, if they're going to make a braggot, they're just going to be making a beer. I guess, I don't know. This is my personal opinion. I haven't really talked to a lot of other meat makers about that.
Interesting. That's a category.
I like braggots.
Oh yeah, I dig them.
Yeah, I like them. I like them, and I think it's hard. What is the difference between a honey beer versus a braggot? And technically, you really want to have more, 51% honey, but that rule's not really set in stone. But if you only had like 5% honey, then that's obviously a honey beer. That's not a braggot.
Yeah, we had
the reason
I'm
laughing is, that was our topic last week, and that's actually come up a number of times on the show, is that subtle difference between the two, and is there even a difference? Because, right, like you said, that's not a set-in-stone rule by any stretch of the imagination.
No. I mean, I know the American Mead Maker Association, not for braggot, but for mead itself, they were trying to set a rule like that because, if you're commercial and a winery down the road is making a quote mead because it's trendy and they want to get some of the business, but it only 10% of the fermentable is honey. So it's basically a wine that has a little honey in it. That's maybe not so fair to like somebody who's actually doing it with mostly honey and it's a more expensive fermentable. And the public might not be educated enough to know the difference. They just are happy to get their sweet wine, whatever it is. So that's a different thing. I mean, that's coming from an industry perspective. But if you look at if you read the BJCP guidelines, it doesn't say anywhere how much honey has to be in it. And there's not really any way that you can measure it. I mean, I guess you could send off a sample and they could do some chemical analysis and maybe a really smart person could figure that out. But as a judge, we're just going to taste what's in the glass. We don't know what the backstory is. And so you could make it with a lot of honey, but if there's not a lot of honey aroma and flavor, even if there's a lot of honey in it, you might not score as well as compared to somebody who maybe use a little bit less honey, but they fermented it well and it actually comes out. and you can actually smell it and taste it. So yeah, that rule is, I mean, it would be hard to enforce that anyway. I mean, you know, so.
Well,
but a lot of opinions about that.
Yeah, I just, like I said, that's my category of mead right now, because I don't want to say I don't care for it, but I mean, there's some meads out there that I really like, but I'm leaning more towards, and I'm more of a beer drinker than anything else too. I mean, I love my red wines, but I'm more of a beer drinker by habit than anything else. So this, when I was exposed to Braggots for the first time by one of the guys that has a seat at our table here every week, Aaron, I was just, it just blew me away. And I thought, holy crap, this is really good stuff. So that's what I've been concentrating on. And, you know, I've been drinking some different beers, trying to picture, you know, what would this taste like if it had honey involved in it somewhere, and that kind of thing. And so I'm trying some different things. I'm just curious to, you know, as to your experience with Braggots. What have you tried that worked? What hasn't worked for you? Is it something that you can get excited about or want to pursue even
of course.
Further? Or how do you feel about it?
Well, I made a Braggot. It didn't get a medal, but I honestly really like it. And, you know, if you're brewing, whether it's beer or mead, isn't that really what matters, is do you like it? And whether it got a medal or not, I mean, I'm happy to get the medals, but I've made plenty of batches of beer or mead that didn't win a medal, but it was really good. It wasn't anything complex, but it was very tasty, and my friends and family liked it. But I have a Braggot that I made. It was off of a Doppelbach recipe that I had made a few times previously that was really good, and I thought, why not make a Braggot recipe? You know, just make a Doppelbraggot or something like that. And so I wanted to get some more of those toffee notes, so I caramelized the honey, not enough to really call it a Boucher, but just to give a lot, some of those more caramelized notes, because clover honey doesn't have a lot. And I thought if I caramelized it lightly, sort of like a medium amber, that would add to those flavors that you will get in a Bock. And to make a Doppelbock, you have to do what they call decoction brewing, which is you take some of the mash out and then you heat it up. And it's the sort of the caramelization of the grain. They call it the Maillard reaction. It's kind of like what you get on a, you know, roasted meat or something, that browning flavor. And I had made that Doppelbock recipe a few years earlier, and I only did 3 decoctions, and it was pretty good. But when I did 5 decoctions, it was really had that rich Bock flavor. And it was kind of a pain, because you had to take out maybe 20-25% of your mash out, heat it up, put it back into the main batch. But you didn't want to overheat the main batch, so you had to really be taking care with your temperatures and everything. So I did that with the Doppelbraggot, and I really like it. It hasn't gotten a medal yet, but look, it's okay. It's, as long as I like it, that's what matters.
One that Chris was complaining about here a while back, guys.
Yeah, he was talking about he was cussing out the fact that he spent like all day on a 3-part decoction I think it was either a Bock or a Marzen style, which is very similar.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what Chris was cussing about the other day.
That was a funny show. Anyway, well, gosh, Tom, I feel like I could go on and on and on, but we've got another segment that we want to get to before the night's over. Really appreciate you coming on with us here tonight. And the episode, we record them on Tuesday nights around 9 o'clock, and then I dress them up in the morning and get them posted. So the replay will be available tomorrow, usually mid-morning thereafter. So really would love to have you on again. I think there's a whole other set of questions that I would have, even talking about mead competitions and judging and that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's a whole tactic to entering properly to be able to win a medal, you know, and it's about, you know, you have to choose the correct category. So I would love to be on the program again.
Absolutely.
I love making mead, but I love teaching about mead. I think I've had some really terrible meads, unfortunately, some of them are even commercial, sadly, but in some of the judging, and you want to just help people to make the best possible mead they can, because honestly, the bees worked really hard to make that honey. And, you know, all we can do as mead makers is try to make it into something wonderful and not screw it up. And, and so that's why it was so amazing to win the medals that I'd won. It's really humbling for me to have gotten those awards. I don't even see it like I had won anything. It was more just I was given an award or a recognition for what I had done. But I would love to. I'd love to be on the show again.
Absolutely, Tom Rapas. Is that right? Am I saying that right?
Repass.
Tom Repass. And you said you're in Gillette, Wyoming tonight.
I work in Gillette 2 days a week, and then I spend the other 4 days of the week in the Black Hills, where I spend time with my family and with my bees. And some days it seems like I spend more time with my bees than with my family, but you know that's how it goes. But
Awesome country up there. Thanks again, Tom, for joining us tonight, and we will definitely get you on the show again.
Great. I look forward to it.
All right. Tom Repass, I got to say that right. Tom Repass. I don't know what makes me think Repass. Wow. I felt like I could go on and on and on and on with the guy, but I didn't want to keep him up all night. Is everybody else still here?
Yep.
Yeah, that was great hearing from Tom. And like you said, we'd love to have him back.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because there's a whole, you know, and I'm still considering it, guys. I mean, I know, you know, a couple of you have tried to talk me into sending stuff in, but I don't trust myself yet. I don't feel that I'm quite there yet. But I think there's a whole, segment that we could do about competitions. And, now that we have our own resident judge with us, and Tom being a judge as well, plus all of the competitions that he's entered and his experiences with all of them. The ins and outs of competing, you know, and what it means to a home mead maker. I'd really like to get into that. We got an email from a listener, and they're starting to come in more and more and more now. This one happens to be from Ben, and I'm probably going to butcher this last name too, Duthu. I think I forwarded this on to you guys this morning sometime, but Ben writes, he says, "Hey guys, I'm an amateur mead maker, and I just came across the Mead House show and started listening to the backlog of shows. Great show, by the way. I'm not that far into this, this may be a topic that we have covered already. And it may very well be. I don't know, but it's certainly worth going over again. Bottom line, he's just starting out, and apparently he lives in the South, somewhere around in the same neck of the woods that Chris is in. I don't think it's Mississippi, though.
Louisiana.
But he's limited to the type of honey that is readily available, apparently, in his neck of the woods, which he talks about as a local wildflower. At least that's what he has access to. But he wanted to know, are there better sources of honey out there that we could suggest, and any websites that may ship a good quality honey? One thing that I'll mention off the top before I let Ryan and Jeff chime in here is that, Ben, when it comes to shipping honey, it's going to cost a pretty penny. So just be aware of that, because obviously honey weighs quite a bit, and you can go to FedEx or UPS, and you can pretty much do some math and come up with an idea of what the shipping is going to run you based on the poundage that you're going to order. But that being said, Are there places out there that that you two are familiar with that Ben could go and do some shopping?
Well, you know, if I can just jump in here on this, you know, because we all, Jeff and I traded emails on it. And Jeff's got the simple answer, but I'll give the more complicated one. You know, recently I was at the mall and I came across a store that I hadn't seen before that had 32 some honeys that they were sampling from all around the world. And it was unbelievable. I mean, I had honeys from Africa and the Middle East and Europe and Australia and all across the U.S. And, you know, I sent a picture of the guys and everything from practically translucent to, you know, black all along the spectrum. And there were some really amazing honeys with all different types of flavors from very light to very earthy to fruity to sour or dank. And everywhere in between, and they all, a lot of good stuff. They're also extremely expensive. Some of these honeys were more than a dollar an ounce. I'm going to say that again, more than a dollar an ounce, meaning a pound of some of these could cost you $20. Now, you know, our friend Ben said that he's starting out and he's new, to mead making. And I think that's important. That's an important piece of information. I've always said, and you heard Tom say it just, you know, an hour ago, that it takes quality ingredients to make quality mead. I say the same thing, but I say it a little bit differently. You put crap in, you're going to get crap out. Now, Tom also said that it's really important to get your process down. So when you put those two things together, what you get is you need decent honey and you need a very good process. I would not recommend going to buy extremely expensive, extremely exotic honey when you are new to mead making. I would say go find a good everyday honey, you know, a good worker honey for you. And use that, hone your process, hone your style. And when you feel really confident and when you've produced consistent good meads, then expand out if you want into some more exotic, expensive honeys. So back to Ben, where would I go? I'm Ben, I'm learning, I'm new, but I still need some good stuff if I'm going to expect to make some good honey. I would start at your local homebrew store. I would go to a local homebrew store because they've probably got some decent honeys. If it's a good local homebrew store that people are using to make beers, meads, ciders, different wines, you know, that kind of thing. And if you don't have a good local homebrew store, then I would find one, an online one. You know, here at the Mead House, we are not sponsored by any local homebrew store. We do not get any compensation for anybody that purchases anything from any of the stores that we mention. It's just what we typically use. So with that being said, I can tell you that I've had success at both Northern Brewer and Midwest Supplies. They both have some good honeys. They've got some clover, some orange blossom, some Northern Wildflower. And every other week, it seems like they've got a 15 or 20% off sale and they've got pretty reasonable shipping. You hit one of those sales, you essentially get your shipping for free. And you can get some honey that you can feel confident that you can produce a good mead out of. That was the extremely long, complicated answer. And now I'll let Jeff give you the very, very simple one.
So there, as far as simple meats, simple answers go, I do have a simple answer for you. Costco. Costco has 5-pound packages of what they call clover honey. It's very simple. It's It's what do I want to say? It's sourced from Argentina and the U.S., but it's true source verified, so we know it's real honey. It's not cut with corn syrup or you know, simple sugars and things like that that would make it a less a more inferior product. And really, when I talk about starting mead, I consider it training wheels. You know, it's perfectly fine to start with something that's inexpensive and easy to get a hold of like that, to learn your process. You know, to learn those best practices, to get your style down, and start getting from the point where you're just like basically following a rote recipe and getting into a little bit more artistic expression. When it comes to finding good honey, you have some really good resources though. The American Honey Producers, or is it American Honey Board? I forget which, has a honey locator website you can search that will give you, you can search by state to find local beekeepers in your area that are a little bit larger. You can also search by varietal and find, producers that have that specific varietal available. I also happened on a website a couple months ago that I have bookmarked, but I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head. What really struck me is, back in, the fall of 2015, when my wife and I went on honeymoon, we went to Malta and we had this varietal honey there, that I'm not going to mention the name of because I want dibs on making a traditional with it. that was it. The flavor of the honey alone blew our socks off. If I had an extra $300 or $400 lying around, I would have gotten a big bucket of it and checked that as a second bag to bring home. Not bought it, another seat on the plane. we were that impressed with it, but sadly the funds were just not there. We were having too much fun, having a good time. And what struck me about this website is they have a Spanish version of that varietal honey available. And as soon as I can scrape together about $400, $450, I think, with shipping, dollars that I can justify spending on just honey, that I'm going to get me some of that. There are resources available. I can track that down and, put a link to that on our show, Facebook page, either this evening or tomorrow, just so that you have that available. And, there's resources available, but there's also no harm in starting with simple stuff like, that Costco honey, or just stuff from your local beekeeper. You know, it may not be the best quality, but you don't need the best quality when you're learning best practices and you're learning the start of your mead making process and you're getting your feet wet. I mean, even now, I still use the Costco honey for things like Boucher's or really, really, really strong fruit flavors that I know are going to easily overpower some of my honey character anyway. I'm really only just now getting into using more varietal honey than not. And that's after kind of transitioning out to using a lot of like the local wildflower or wildflower from other sources, to where, I look for honey with a particular varietal character. So yeah, it's, there is no harm in starting simple.
I think, from my perspective, Ben, there are three things here that I'm kind of focused in on your email. One, you say you have, that you use local wildflower honey. That's probably a good thing, and there's probably nothing wrong with that honey. But you also say that you've done a couple of batches, and the results were decent. And then the third thing is along with those batches that you've done, you also say that any off flavors that arise could be due to errors on your part. You're entirely correct on that. And so, going back to what Tom and Ryan, what we've always said on the show, there are many things to take a look at before you even put the honey in the bucket. Sanitation would be one thing. What kind of vessels are you fermenting in? Is it in an area in your house or where you live that you have some degree of some kind of temperature control. And then you can go on into things like what kind of yeast are you using? Are you following any kind of a rigorous nutrient schedule? You know, are you giving the mead that you're making all it's due? In other words, are you managing it? I mean, it's like having a kid at home. You just can't put a plate of food in front of its face and expect it to, well, I guess some kids you could, but, you know what I'm getting at. You have to manage this stuff. So, there are many things that you can start out with using your local wildflower honey, which may be just as good a honey as you would get from other sources, outside sources. So I hope this has been a big help to you, Ben. We'll follow up. Obviously, you're probably going to get, you may get the email before you hear this. But I always usually follow up after we record the show with an email to listeners who have written in, and we've responded back to them. So that being said, guys, I really don't have anything else to really want to talk about tonight, other than this this Polish. I'm calling it Polish. I don't know if you saw the labels on my. I think I put them up on our Facebook page, the labels that I had made from Grog Tag. Really cool labels, vinyl labels. But this
Love
Polish...
Those vinyl labels.
Oh, yeah. I tell you, that's the only way to go. They weren't too terribly expensive, and they peel off the bottle really easily. They're waterproof. And have nothing but good things to say about Grog Tag. But this Polish wildflower braggot that I'm drinking, just like the last one that I had on the show, is coming true to form here. I mean, you take a big whiff out of the glass and tons of honey aroma. And it's this, you know, and I think Ryan has talked about it before, this perception thing. Man, you get this this nose full of honey, this wildflower honey, but yet when you take a sip, there's nothing sweet about it at all. But that aroma leaves a really good taste in your mouth. So I guess, or maybe Jeff's talked about it, this perceived thing going on, you know? But this is really good. So,
yeah, and I've heard of the Polish beer that you would base that on, and actually wanted to play with that a little bit myself. I mean, I don't know if I discussed it on the show previously, but my bachelor's degree was in Czech and Polish, and I've spent some time in Poland and enjoyed traveling around there. I was not in the least bit into mead at the time. I was drinking a lot more hard alcohol and their lager beer at the time. The notion of this Polish beer that is being kind of rediscovered right now is really interesting to me. So I've wanted to check that out myself.
Cool. Anything else to add, Ryan, before we close it out?
I think we've done a great job tonight answering a lot of questions and getting some great information.
Yeah, and again, thanks to Tom Repass for coming on the show. Really want to get him back on the show, so we need to figure out a show or at least a couple of segments to work out with him and maybe get him back on the show here. You know, over the course of the next however long we're going to be doing this. So, Chris, if you're out there going to listen to this thing, I hope you had a successful surgery tonight. I know you got tied up there at the hospital. And Aaron, we know what you're up to, so and we'll see you next week. So other than that, guys, I guess we'll come back to the table next Tuesday night right around 9 o'clock and do this all over again.